The Guardian.
Book of the Week with Claire Armistead on guardian.co.uk.
It's May, and that means hay. No, not the yellow stuff that is ripening in the fields around the small Welsh town of Hay-on-Wye, but the literary festival that will be in full bloom by next weekend. In this week's podcast, we'll be looking at some of the treats in store. We'll hear from festival director Peter Florence, and I'll be joined by some of the team who'll be covering it for The Guardian and who've been scouring the programme for the writers and debates you just can't afford to miss. Among the star writers at Hay is the novelist Barbara Trepido, who joined us for a sneak preview of her new novel. It's called Sex and Stravinsky, and it's an intricately plotted novel which interweaves two families on two continents. Sarah Crown asked her to begin by explaining where her characters stand as the story begins.
It's really six people dancing around each other and finally coming together around a kind of magical boy who draws them back to where some of them started out. But it starts with two graduate students meeting in London in the late 70s. That's Josh and Caroline. What happens in the novel really is each of the six characters has a chapter to him or herself.
The structure that is almost like a Shakespearean comedy structure of two couples who are mismatched and their two daughters, and there are a lot of doublings and mirrorings and shadows. And it's a very sort of stagey setup in that sense, isn't it? All the coincidences, you know, the book is absolutely jam-packed with coincidences, people turning up in odd places and discovering things that, you know, you wouldn't expect to be discovered. So it moves the novel really right to the edge of realism in a way. And was that, did that present any problems for you when you were writing it? Or did you kind
of
really...
It only occurred to me 3 days ago that this novel... had Shakespearean resonances, though I was vaguely aware that I was, you know, I did see it had a kind of formality about its structure. And I suppose to the extent I was aware of it, that related in my mind more to dance. But I do see that there is that. I saw the story having a lot to do with people's lives taking, you know, going on these very... unpredictable trajectories where people end up very far from where they started out and having great confusions about their identities. I think it's got to do with the fact that there's a lot of deception and people either not being quite sure of who they are or pretending to be people whom they aren't, as in the case of the magical boy who transforms himself into a Francophone African by taking on someone else's identity.
The sort of the blank heart at the centre of it, isn't it?
Yes, I saw him as a person that these people would kind of revolve separately like planets, and then he would be the magnet around which would bring them together, at which point, you know, in a sense, metaphorically speaking, the masks would drop and they would blink and see each other with new eyes and try themselves out in different roles, you know, step into each other's lives. And get a second chance, having made such a muddle of it first time round.
Certainly one aspect of that, of the reality of the book, is about South Africa, where part of the story is set. And the boy, the central blank boy whom we were talking about, Jack, he is the son of a housemaid, a black housemaid, but then he has a white father. And as we were saying, he becomes sort of the cipher for the whole book, this idea of identity that can be acquired and sort of sloughed off. And I think that you grew up in South Africa, is that right?
Yes, I did.
How was it to go back to it in writing, to revisit it in this way?
I'd actually started this book, but this book I wrote in my usual intuitive, dreamy, staring into the dark kind of way. And, you know, so for quite a long time, I'm really not sure why I'm writing about these people or what they're telling me about themselves. And... because I couldn't work that out, I thought, I'm going to go on holiday from this book and just put it away and let it gestate. And I wrote a book that's quite different from all my others, a host of small stories, real true life stories of my growing up in South Africa. When I went back to that book thinking, aha, I see what's happening. But I think because I'd written all that South African stuff, one of the things I'd been left with from that book was precisely how in the New World almost everybody is from somewhere else. But it's so marked in New World societies, which are wholly immigrant societies. So that even though when I grew up, we were, you know, divided by this horrible racist caste system, and I went to school with not only exclusively white children, but white girl children. We were hugely ethnically mixed because everybody's parents had come from Angola or Italy or Germany, or they were German Jewish refugees or East European Jewish refugees from 1930s Europe.
What about some of the female characters in the book? I thought Caroline in particular felt very much to me like a character whom I'd met to a certain extent in books of yours before, sort of very physically prepossessing, very strong woman. Fans of your work, I think, you know, will recognise her to an extent. What is it that draws you to these female characters?
I don't know why. I suppose Caroline, I found her so objectionably prodigious and judgmental in every way. I was quite surprised when the first people who read the book said, "Oh, poor Caroline, she's having such a hard time." And I thought, yeah, I suppose she is. But I did have a lot of fun inventing more and more prodigious things for her to do. And you know, the way she can endlessly make wedding dresses out of old festoon blinds and so on.
Yes, the clothes thing again is something that...
The clothesy thing. I could just endlessly invent her clothes and her prodigious kind of cooking and gardening and DIY skills and so on.
And Kim, let's talk finally about the title of the novel, Sex and Stravinsky. Why did he give it that title?
Well,
it's
pretty
punchy.
The title fell into place rather a long time ago, and since I take rather long time over books and took rather longer than usual over this one, because I took out 4 years while I was caring for my husband, who'd had a stroke and was quite in bed, so I was even slower than usual. It just fell onto the page because when I first started the book, I was asked for an extract from my novel in progress for a charity anthology that Waterstones were bringing out. And I just happened to be writing a little vignette where Hattie and Josh, as undergraduate best friends, were bouncing off each other over this autobiography of Stravinsky, of which had a portrait of the composer on the cover, and they're discussing whether or not Stravinsky's glasses are sexy. And there's actually not a huge amount of sex in the book. There's a bit of a scene over Caroline's inevitably homemade silver Hollywood pyjamas, which she's made out of a 1940s bedspread. Yeah, I now feel I'm rather too old to have a title like that, but there it is, you see. It's my fault for being so slow.
Barbara Trepido. Sex and Stravinsky is published by Bloomsbury, and she'll be talking to me on stage at Hay on Friday, June the 4th. But there'll be lots more going on before then, not least in our daily Guardian Haycast, featuring interviews and features, music and talk from the festival. This year we'd like you to get involved too. We want to put your questions to our interviewees. So if you have anything you've always wanted to ask Bill Bryson, Henning Mankell, Sue Townsend or Mal Peet, then email us your question now. We'll sift through the best ones and put them to the authors we talk to in our Haycasts. You can find a list of who we're speaking to and how to send us a question at guardian.co.uk/bookspodcast. Later on in the programme, I'll explain when and where you can find this year's Haycast, so keep listening for that. However, going back to basics, earlier I managed to snatch a moment with festival organiser Peter Florence, who must be the busiest man in Wales right now. He joined me on the phone to talk through some of his own highlights.
Well, after, you know, 24 years of doing this, we finally managed to persuade Tom Stoppard to come, which I have to say is, for me, a huge personal highlight. So I'm incredibly excited by that. I'm very intrigued by the different versions of the political stuff that we're going to get. I mean, there are people from Greenstock and the French ambassador and the Pakistani president who will all give very, very different views of what we've been going through with the Chilcot inquiry. Is viewed around the world. And I think trying to get beyond the British vision of what's happened in Iraq and Afghanistan is fascinating, actually, and will be, I think, instructive. Beyond that, however much you look forward to things, it's always the left field stuff that catches you unawares, that becomes the highlight afterwards of the festival, that you suddenly realize there are things that will become meaningful in, you know, 3 weeks or 6 months or 2 years' time that will happen. And that's the energy of festivals. They create really surprising, buzzy contexts for people to surprise you.
Now, you've had the unenviable task of programming a festival without knowing what the political landscape was going to look like. Have you had any late additions since the result of the election was known?
Well, yeah, we have, actually, which is thrilling. I mean, on the one hand, Hay sits between Brecon and Radnor, which is old, great Liberal constituency, and Herefordshire South, which is traditionally a kind of Liberal Conservative constituency, which now has a very progressive Conservative MP. Hay itself, the festival has always been at the more progressive end of this. And for my part, I'm thrilled that we have, on the one hand, Alistair Campbell looking back at the past, who's launching his unexpurgated memoir here. And on the other hand, we have Ed Miliband coming to do a big future of the Labour Party session with the Guardian's Ian Katz on the first weekend. Now, that for me is kind of quite exciting as we begin to understand what's going on with the new coalition.
Just one last thing. I have to ask you this. What are the long-term weather forecasts looking like?
The long-term weather forecasts are looking favourable, but they are, of course, forecasts. All I can tell you is that today in Hay-on-Wye there is gorgeous sunshine, a light breeze, and it's definitely a sort of a temperature for linens and ice creams.
Peter Florence on the phone from Hay earlier. I've also been talking to Guardian political pundit and podcaster Tom Clark and my Haycast co-presenter, Sarah Crown, about some of the events that have caught their eyes. Now, Tom, the timing of this festival means it's really the first chance for public discussion of all the new issues that have come up since the election. Do you see that reflected in the programme?
Well, no, the striking thing is, Claire, that I don't see that in the programme at all. David Cameron launched the campaign that we've just seen on the back of what he promised would be a big idea. And if we were taking that at face value, we might expect there'd be a few books about this thing, The Big Society, which he claimed was the animating idea for the new administration. In fact, what we see, as well as a load of predictable wash-up stuff from Alistair Campbell and people like Andrew Rawnsley, who've chronicled the new Labour years, are a load of ideas that are big and powerful and interesting, but are still coming very much from the centre-left. So in terms of Keynesian economics, in terms of the environment and so on.
Talking about Keynesian economics, there is a very interesting Tory chairing that particular talk with Robert Skidelsky, isn't there?
There certainly is. Robert Skidelsky himself is one of the few people to have resigned from at least three and arguably four political parties. He was in Labour and then he resigned to join the SDP, moved to the Tories and resigned from that as well. So he defies any kind of left-right classification. And the meeting is being chaired by one of the most interesting and bright new Conservative MPs, Jesse Norman, who's the MP for Hereford, and who has written a book not so much about Keynesian economics as about the need to put ethics back into economics. And if we were to look anywhere around the Hay programme for things that have got something to do with this idea, if there is a big thing called the Big Society, but it's not the same thing as the state, then Jesse Norman would be a very good person to ask about it.
Hay's always taken a bigger view of politics, though, hasn't it? I mean, and there's an awful lot here, particularly on the environmental front.
Absolutely. No, I mean, it would be very weird, actually, if these books had already been written that set out exactly what David Cameron's mission is. But I suppose what I mean is, if you think back to 96, 97, you may have been at Hay. I certainly wasn't. But things like the state we're in were probably doing the rounds, and we're not necessarily seeing a kind of analogue to that. Having said that, we've got this interesting discussion about the public realm. Now, that might have something of interest to the kind of new Conservatives. And David Cameron personally has tended to push the environmental agenda, and there's a lot of questions about whether the Green movement's got it wrong. And if you're a pragmatic person who does care about the environment, that might be a great deal of interest to you, the stuff that Mark Lynas is talking about.
What about the economy? We've got people like Howard Davis, LSE director, former CBI chief. His talk is called Back from the Brink. I mean, that sounds a bit hopeful to me, does it? You?
It sounds a little bit hopeful to me as well, but we want people to take different views of this and try and make sense of what's going on. It's a situation that's been all about uncertainty. Everyone was uncertain on how big the bets were. Then it became clear sometime around autumn 2008 that the bigs were the bets were both very big and had gone very wrong. And now people are trying to work out where that leaves us. And, you know, I think it's great that there's different people, some taking a more upbeat assessment and some kind of pouring on the normal doom. And Robert Skidelsky, we already talked about, just putting it in a longer perspective. That should be fascinating.
Mm-hmm. There are also quite a few very interesting international speakers. I was actually attacked, well, actually pleasantly attacked by a Pakistani novelist friend of mine at a party the other day for inviting Musharraf. Now, I had to assure her that we have nothing to do with inviting Musharraf. Peter is his own master at Hay. But what do you think about this? There are some controversial figures at this Hay, aren't there?
Well, General Musharraf launches a coup to go with Pakistan. It's not a kind of democratic figure as we understand it at all. Having said that, Pakistan is a big and increasingly important part of the world for sort of overall security, and the whole issue of fight of Western force with the Taliban is, of course, intimately linked with Pakistan, because Pakistan sponsored the takeover of the Taliban in the first place. If we want to understand it, we need people to talk more. And you've always got this question, do you want to take the John Major line and say it's time to condemn a little more and understand a little less? Or, as I think would be a better approach for people organising book festivals, do we need to talk to people and see what they think about things?
Of course, Sarah, we did have the rather wonderful political spectacle a couple of years ago of George Monbiot doing a citizen's arrest, didn't we?
Yes, unfortunately, this was the year that I missed Hay, so I didn't see it, but I read all about it. And I think it really galvanised the event. And I wonder, yes, whether we'll see something this dramatic this time round.
I noticed in the programme that they say no sharp objects had been taken into the talks involving Musharraf, but also the Israeli ambassador to London.
Yeah, it's a pretty terrifying thing to say. But then I thought, well, you know, these talks will take place in tents, so perhaps they're worried about people kind of cutting their way free halfway through. But I guess we'll have to wait and see what happens.
The real test will be if you have to take your shoes off if someone tries the trick of the Iraqi on George Bush.
Yeah. Now, Sarah, I know that something that matters very much to you is literature, which we haven't actually got round to talking about at all. We have to remember that this is first and foremost a book festival.
Yes, and as usual, there is a huge array of absolutely brilliant authors, and it's a really exciting programme this year. Of the heavyweight novelists, I'm particularly excited, I think, about hearing from Helen Dunmore. She's in conversation with Anthony Beaver, and I loved her new novel about 1950s Leningrad. It's called The Betrayal, and it'll be fascinating to hear her talking to Beaver about the place where history and fiction meet and how you negotiate the territory in between them, which is what Dunmore's done in her latest book.
And that's Anthony Beaver, the historian.
Yes,
so,
yeah.
So then they're both talking,
they're talking
both dealt with
period.
Leningrad particularly.
Yeah, that'll be a really interesting event to go to. Elsewhere, the wonderful Hilary Mantel is going to be appearing ostensibly to talk about Wolf Hall, her book, which has just won everything. But what I'm really hoping, if I go to her event, is that she'll talk about the sequel to Wolf Hall, The Mirror and the Light. And that will definitely be one to go along to if she does reveal anything about it. Also, she's just a great talker. You can't go wrong if you go to an event of hers. And the same's true of Jeanette Winterson, who's there to celebrate 25 years since she wrote Orange is Not the Only Fruit again. She's just a brilliant person to go and listen to. And Roddy Doyle, too, who's talking about The Dead Republic, which is the final instalment of his Henry Smart trilogy. So he should be popular, I think, as well.
Tom, some of the novelists are quite political, like Ian McEwan is going to be there. He's, of course, his most recent novel is called Solar, and it's about climate change, apart from anything else.
You get people like Roddy Doyle, who I always feel kind of political in a really gentle way, which I always feel is where I like politics most in fiction, where it's just about the sort of struggles that people face that often get lost in, big picture waffly talk from Labour leadership candidates about aspiration and deep renewal and the rest of it, but kind of imagining how someone feels in Barrytown when they've just lost their job, I think that's a pretty good way to reconnect with what politics should really be about.
Yeah, he's such a great, amusing speaker as well, isn't he, Roddy Doyle? And he's there, of course, to launch the last part of his Henry Smart trilogy. And what about poetry, Sarah?
Well, poetry, we have Simon Armitage. He's there to launch his new collection, Seeing Stars. And again, he's a Hay stalwart, a great speaker, great voice for radio, as everyone knows. So I'll be really looking forward to hearing from him. And
Tobias Hill. We all rather like Tobias
we
Hill
do.
In this office.
Yes, and he was at Hay last year as a novelist. This time he's here as a poet. He's sort of a Renaissance man. And so he's here to talk about his poetry this time around. And then Philip Gross, who won the T.S. Eliot Prize, he'll be reading from his collection, The Water Table, which I think will be definitely
Now, Philip Gross also has an interesting sideline in Pylon Feet. Can you explain to me a little bit about that?
Yes, it's a book that melds poetry and photography, which is something that, you know, people have done in the past, but he's done it rather beautifully, taking photographs of the bottom of pylons and then writing about them.
And that's up for Wales Book of the Year, yes. Which seems extraordinary. Pylon feet, you'd expect it to be about sheep or something, wouldn't you?
But then, you know, if you look in the countryside around Hay, lots of pylons, so perhaps it's a good place to be doing it.
And, of course, it's May half term, which means that there'll be lots and lots of children. What is on the agenda for them?
Yes, this I'm actually really excited about, because I've previously, when I've been to the festival, I've been there for both the weekends and not for the week, and that's the bit when Hay Fever, the Hay Festival children's section, happens. And Hay is just an amazing place for kids. It's great if you want to bring your children, and they really attract some of the biggest names in children's fiction. So this year we've got Quentin Blake, Cressida Cowell, Jacqueline Wilson, Francesca Simon, and the children's laureate Anthony Brown is going to be there. Personally, though, I'm most excited about Mal Pete. He'll be talking about Exposure, and that's the third book in his Paul Faustino series. And it's absolutely brilliant. And I'm going to be interviewing him for the Haycast this year. And of course, it won last year's Guardian Children's Fiction Prize. And that's another thing that happens at Hay. We launch the long list for the Children's Fiction Prize
and
this year.
And invite all the young critics to come along and start reviewing the books for us.
And that's happening on the Wednesday. So do come along if you're there. And another thing that we'll be covering on the Haycast.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the highlights of last year's festival for me was the Cambridge series of lectures, which is happening again. And there are 17 lectures this year, ranging from climate change to the body to astronomy to Jane Austen. I think that it's the most, that is in a way one of the best things about the festival. You could just sign up for a lecture a day and get world-class lecturers telling you about things you know nothing about. Last year I learnt about biosensors, and my life will never be the same again. As for the curiosities, do you have any? That's another of the lovely things about Hay. Have you spotted any curiosities?
One item that is sure to catch people's eyes is Alan de Botton talking to Jerry Hall. I can't imagine what that's going to involve, but
whose
certainly
fantasy do you think that was?
Really wouldn't like to know. But yes, I imagine that you know, kind of will be packed out.
And on the children's side, there's Paul Kiev, who's the illusionist who worked on the Harry Potter films. So you might find some disappearing children, which might be quite useful for harassed parents who want to go and do something serious. Tom Clark and Sarah Crown. We'll be podcasting from Hay all next week, a daily podcast throughout the festival, starting on Saturday with Kazuo Ishiguro and Peter Hitchens. Register for the programme to be sent to you free now at guardian.co.uk/bookspodcast. Before then, however, in The Guardian's review on Saturday, we'll be looking at the politics and literature of that other small event that's about to kick off, the World Cup. And on Sunday, The Observer's new review will be extracting Jackie Kay's new memoir, Red Dust Road. That's it for this week's podcast. I'm Claire Armistead, and the programme was produced by Scott Corley.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.